You're listening to Psych Talk.
You're on the first video blog for Psych Talk. Usually we do our interviews at this radio station. I'm currently at the studio of WCOM in Carborough, North Carolina. Okay. And speaking with me here on Psych Talk is Todd Stiefel. He's a secular humanist and atheist and a full-time free thought activist living in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's the co-host of the Humanist Hour podcast, a great podcast, a behemoth compared to Psych Talk, just a great listen, and a very nice introduction with all these rock stars telling you why you should tune in. And among his many roles, Todd is active in the free thought movement, and he serves on the advisory board of the Secular Coalition of America. I'm sorry, this is the Secular Coalition for America.
Yeah, right? That trips everyone up. It's okay. We do it ourselves sometimes.
Okay, so I get a pass on that one.
Absolutely.
Todd Stiefel has given more than $3 million to charities in the free thought movement, including the nonprofit he founded, the Stiefel Free Thought Foundation. So, Todd, thanks so much for doing this with me.
Absolutely. It's great to be here. Look forward to having some fun.
Yeah. And we're going to have some atheism, sociology, religion sort of fun. My first question is more just a general sort of status update on where atheism is in the United States, because you're really on the front lines where you can tell where public sentiment is heading and who is coming out of the atheist closet. So tell us about atheists.
Well, atheists, as far as a demographic, is something that's kind of hard to nail down a little bit with the data out there. But a Pew survey data piece came out just this week indicating that 19% of Americans are nones, meaning atheist, agnostic, or non-religious. So we're about 1 in 5 adults in the country right now. And that number is dramatically higher in younger categories. So the under 30 crowd, I've seen numbers ranging from 25 to over 30% of the country. So this is a very large demographic segment. We are larger than African Americans or Hispanics, and we are also growing very, very quickly. We've doubled in size in around the last 15 years. So if trends continue, especially given how large of a percentage we are of younger demographics, we could easily be a third of the country in another 10 to 20 years. So we are large and growing quickly. One complexity you may have noticed on that stat is it's nones, no religious affiliation. Now, sure, a lot of them are atheists and agnostics, but some might not be. So the data I usually use there is from the American Religious Identification Survey, or ARIS, which came out in 2008, was the last time that was done, where they actually went beyond just identity questions. So do you identify as an atheist or agnostic or something along those lines? But delved into actual questions of belief. Do you believe in a god, or do you believe in gods, or do you not know? And with that, 12.3% of the country was specifically atheist or agnostic in terms of what their belief system was. But that goes back 4 or 5 years, so that's probably 13 or 14% now.
Times are changing. So what do you think is driving the trend toward more nones, more atheists in the United States?
I think there's a lot of things driving it, but the number one source is access to information, primarily the internet. And whereas in before, for thousands of years, we would be killed or have our books burned or both. Now, it's much harder to contain the information that we want to, that we have, and we have much better access to be able to look up things and learn on our own. So people who have questions at one point in time may have only had access to the Bible to answer them. Now they have access to billions of documents online that might not always agree with the Bible. They can go out and learn for themselves and form their own judgments. And I think that's helpful because it makes people better Christians or Muslims, because they can go out and answer their questions they have about their own faith. But many times the answers they find are not acceptable and leads them down a different path. So I think that's the number one source, and I think it's going to continue and grow. But additionally, there's been, because of a lot of it because of the internet, but also because there's been some people out there that have been very outspoken about their beliefs in the last 10 or 15 years and been a lot more willing to criticize religion than maybe what's happening in the decades before, particularly after the Red Scare. And so you get some of the people like the new atheists that they're referred to as Hitchens, Harris, Dawkins, Dennett, and the like, that were much more public and open and kind of opened the door to all sorts of other atheists to have their voices, some of them as maybe aggressively as some of the new atheists, and some of them maybe a little bit more diplomatically.
Some of those new atheists, the four of them, I think, had called the four horsemen of the yep. atheist apocalypse sometimes.
Exactly.
It's an easy way to group them together and remember them. I sort of like that label because there is sometimes something a little barbed about Richard Dawkins or Daniel Dennett, almost something that's not very appeasing, that's not going to win over someone who needs a more gentle approach. But it seems like the internet is helping people out. Speaking of people learning about atheism through the internet and being able to inform themselves, go on their own journey of rational discovery, tell us about this Ask an Atheist column you did for The Blaze, or sort of a Q&A where you were the atheist. Who was the audience there, and how were they reacting to your ideas?
Well, the audience there was The Blaze, primarily The Blaze readership, but also a lot of free thinkers went there and read about it after hearing about it through various free thought networks, whether it be blogs like Friendly Atheist or other places. So it was kind of an interesting thing. That all started at the Reason Rally, actually, where I found out afterwards, because things were so crazy that day, that there had been a writer from The Blaze who was looking for conservative atheists and humanists to talk to. And they got to a friend of mine, Brother Richard, who referred them to me, but I was kind of unavailable in the chaos at that point in time, and decided I'd follow up with them and see what they were interested in. And so they did a profile on me. And that went really well and became really popular on their site. I almost didn't do it, by the way, because I was really hesitant about what Glenn Beck's media group, The Blaze, might say and what kind of
potential misquoting.
Yes, what kind of biases they might have. And, you know, I have to give them a lot of credit. They were very fair, very friendly and kind. I mean, the person I worked with is, you know, an evangelical Christian, but he was great. He was really nice and I think did a good job. And that went so well that I suggested we do some follow-up stuff, because in the comment section, there was a lot of ignorance about atheism, and a lot of questions were asked that weren't answered. So, well, why don't we do an Ask an Atheist? So they said yes, and we've done four of them so far, and they've been pretty darn popular on their site and have been entertaining for me, but also a bit disappointing when you read the comments, because there's clearly some people who just don't get it, or there's also a lot of people I've noticed who don't even read the article before posting comments, yeah. which is somewhat amusing.
Yeah. Yeah, online commenting is its own microcosm that isn't well simulated anywhere in the real world. They're just the trolls, and lots of strange behavior happens when people are anonymous.
Yes, very much so. That's a whole another psychology discussion, because it's not just atheist forums, although sometimes there's some dialogue around that, but I mean, I was even in a guitar forum recently where there was somebody talking about how he'd gotten death threats for criticizing a certain guitar pedal. It's like, what?
What has the world come to?
It's like, you heretic! That overdrive is great!
Yeah. Well, actually, this whole issue was, this is a complete tangent, well, I'll end it quickly, but this whole issue of trolling on the internet was a big news item for The Dark Knight Rises, the new Batman movie. Mm-hmm. On Rotten Tomatoes, as soon as reviewers started putting in a few negative reviews, they got death threats. And the movie hadn't come out yet, so it was impossible to give them death threats based on any understanding of the actual movie.
Right. They had to shut down the comment section, and it's just crazy. The anonymity can bring out the nastiest in people, regardless of where you are, whether it's movies, atheism, or guitars. And it's a little scary, too. I mean, that people feel like they can, you know, openly issue death threats and the like. And, you know, I have I'm not a libertarian, but I have libertarian leanings. And it kind of, you get into this debate of where should the government's place be? And should we have a little bit more policing? And we probably should. There's a lot of crime going on online, and it seems like very, very poor enforcement about it. People shouldn't be subjected to death threats without consequences to the people issuing the threats. So
Right.
Which, frankly, is an issue in our movement. I mean, a lot of our leaders get death threats all the time. I mean, I know people who wear bulletproof vests when they speak publicly because they're so afraid of getting shot at.
By some kind of extremist, fanatic.
Yep.
Well, that's one way you can transplant religion into daily life. But a way that I want to think about how religion can translate for everyday people is how religious institutions might be a source of inspiration for atheists. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Reason Rally, a huge secular event. Seems like a lot of good has come out of that, and a gathering of all kinds of organizations involved in secular, free-thinking, humanist movements. And that seems like the closest to me that has happened so far to some kind of like atheist mecca or atheist spiritual event. But I'm somewhat swayed by Alain de Botton's book, Religion for Atheists, in which he argues that religions have been around for a long time. They've been very successful bringing people together, and there's some things that they're doing, whether it's, you know, having mass, eating together, having a non-judgmental space together where you contemplate something more transcendent than the daily squabbles. You're laughing, so I'll let you cut me off.
No. I was just laughing at the point about non-judgmental, because if there's a place that's judgmental, it's a church. But go ahead. Keep going.
Theoretically, you come into a church and the usual stratification of class and race and whatnot is dissolved. And really what I think is happening is a certain sort of tribalism at a psychological level. You're willing to accept your church, they're your in-group, but then you're fortifying against everyone else who doesn't have who aren't the true believers, who don't go through the same rituals. So there's that divisive aspect of community. But community also has benefits. And I already blogged about this, podcasted about this. I did a sort of roundtable here in Carrboro where we were talking about, you know, people can recover from cancer faster, or they'll have a longer lifespan if they have active involvement in church. And this is just statistical averages, and there might be, you know, lots of confounds. But I think there's enough evidence to say that being part of some kind of community involvement, church or otherwise, is healthy. Loneliness is unhealthy.
Right.
And having a support group, a safety net, is healthy, right? And so do you think there's any hope for a secular sort of church, be it a YMCA-style thing or Unitarian Universalist-style, like take the God out of the Christian model? How much hope is there in that?
Well, I think that's something that's happening now to a small degree, is growing quickly, and you're going to be seeing a lot more of it as time goes by. I think that, you know, churches are and religions are memes, and they're essentially cultural units of evolution, and they've evolved and kept certain attributes that either benefit the institution itself or benefits the people within it. And oftentimes it's a combination of both. That doesn't mean what they believe is true, but it may actually have benefits. And I think one of the things that we as secularists are doing is looking at those models and trying to reverse engineer it. And we're way behind. I mean, it wasn't very long ago where being an atheist in America, even though we have mostly freedom of speech, could get your career ruined and end you in prison during the Red Scare. So we've only been very vocal and open last 20, 30 years again in this country. We were more so before there with people like Robert Ingersoll. But we're way behind on the curve. We're not getting burned to death at the stake anymore, and now we're able to start playing catch-up after millennia. But those community centers are, you know, and having real estate is one of those pieces where we're way behind. You know, churches used to kill us and take our land. So that makes it hard.
Takes a while.
It makes it hard to be on par. But one of the things several of us are looking at, and something that I would like to see happen in time, is this reverse engineering, where we look at what are the aspects of religion that they do well, and what are the aspects that they don't do well, and why don't we build it up from scratch? And we don't have to have our memes evolve as much as we can build something taking the best of and getting rid of the rest. We can keep the parts that are true. We can keep the parts that are fun. We can keep the parts that are beautiful. We can keep the parts that are community building. And heck, we could even keep some of the parts that might create a certain sense of awe or joy, or the things that are, frankly, basic psychological and physiological reactions, rushes of certain neurotransmitters that some people attribute to having the Holy Spirit. Well, yet probably not the Holy Spirit, considering people in other religions feel the exact same thing. Is it the Holy Spirit, or is it Allah, or is it Vishnu, or the spirit horse? You know, or maybe it's just basic chemistry. And I think it's biochemistry at work, and there's ways that we can actually harness these things in the secular community to our advantage and to the advantage of the people around us. So I think there's a very large future in that.
Right, and I agree that in reverse engineering is an interesting way to describe it. One aspect of the reverse engineering that would seem tough to me is that some of the emotional flavor of religious experience comes from and seems almost contingent on the beliefs themselves. It's almost like you need the Vishnu there or the actual God in the sky. In fact, I was just interviewing someone today who had a near-death out-of-body experience, and she said she talked to neuroscientists and surgeons who had an explanation for her, but it's just so much more satisfying to think she has an immaterial soul invested with a purpose, and she made a choice to come back because she was needed. And that's part of the awe of the experience for her. And it's possible to still have an awe at our bodies and the cosmos and consciousness without that belief. But would you agree that in some cases, it's harder to bring out the same feeling that, you know, to talk about the sort of rush of neurotransmitters that's happening when you're in the presence of God, that it's going to take more work mentally, cognitively to get to that place without magical beliefs?
Maybe. Well, like, let's take the example of near-death experience. I mean, this has been pretty much proven that this is the effects of lack of oxygen on the brain. This can happen. That's why it happens in every culture, regardless of religion, regardless of the belief system, and it can happen to secular people too. It's physiology at this point. So, you know, can I have the experience of near death, and will I see, you know, angels and whatnot? I don't know. Starve my brain of oxygen long enough, and who knows what I might see. You know,
yeah.
Maybe I'll see angels. Maybe I'll see Darth Vader. I don't know. It'll likely depend on the indoctrination or lack thereof the person has experienced. But I think states like that may be easier if you have the good old fashioned carrot and stick of heaven and hell. But I think that it requires research and it requires looking into things, and it's entirely possible we can get these states without any kind of hocus pocus or fiction involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, one function of religions that is involved with public perception of atheists is that they enforce morality. How can atheist communities or humanists do that? By enforced morality, I mean there's a belief system where a God is watching you or is encouraging you and setting down mandates and potentially punishing you. And so it's mostly the beliefs. There's also just everyone else in the community becomes a sort of prison guard in the group expectations, and people who are part of a church become very mindful of that. Do you think... I mean, and they're preachers, right? There's someone goes up to a pedestal and tells you, here's a good way to live your life, here's some kind of allegory to live your life. And to some extent, a humanist can do that, a Unitarian sort of non-theistic person can do that. Do you think that's positive to have preachers who tell you what's the right thing to do?
No, not the way you phrased it. Having somebody telling you what the right thing to do is not positive. Have somebody giving you advice and you deciding for yourself is positive. And I think having preachers out there that provide guidelines and concepts for people to think about can be. But the problem is that's not often the way it goes. It's not typically a preacher getting up there going, well, this is what I think. What do you think? Now let's ask some questions and see if you agree. It's usually, this is what the Bible says, or this is what I say, or this is what the Pope says, or this is what some authority figure says, and you now need to do it or you're going to burn in hell forever. And whether that hell threat is made implicitly or explicitly, the reality is it's often based on this. Religions very typically are based on promises that are impossible for one to figure out will be granted, such as life after death. So basically false promises that can't be called, or threats that also can't be called, such as eternal hell. And yeah, those things may be useful for some people in keeping them in line, but I think that's kind of a pathetic morality there. When if the only reason someone's not killing other people is because they're afraid of going to hell, well, I hope they keep believing. You know, that's kind of a joke that goes around in the secular community, but it's true. I mean, hey, if the only reason you're not going to kill someone is you hope to be able to go to heaven, keep your religion, please. You know, obviously you have some serious psychological problems and, you know, go ahead, keep your voodoo. But there's a lot of reasons to be moral people, and whether they be purely ethical ones or purely cultural ones or purely legal ones. We have entire legal frameworks that give additional pressures to act well towards others. And frankly, I believe that we are all born with an instinct for right and wrong. I mean, children understand it from the various early ages, whether they're provided with religion or not. And frankly, we all feel, unless we are literally psychopaths, we all feel a sense of guilt when we harm and a sense of joy when we help. And that's humanity. That's universal across all religions and all non-religions. It's humans. And oh, wait, it's not just humans. It's the animal kingdom as well. We see elephants taking care of each other and putting their own lives at risk to save each other from mud. We see all sorts of animals helping out their own species and other species. This is just part of the way we evolved, and we evolved to have a certain level of good built into us, but we also have a certain level of greed built into us. And part of the way I think we can achieve a state of higher ethical living is by facing the reality of we're capable of great good and we're capable of great evil. Let's stop trying to hide those facts and let's accept them and work within that framework of what we are, what we've been built with genetically, and move forward to find ways of living the most ethical and humanitarian ways we can.
Right, right.
We were on ethics and authoritarian pastors and things along those lines when you cut out. I'm not sure exactly what you were saying because you cut out. But
yeah, if I could just quickly restate, I feel like pastors or moral mentors need to have a certain authoritarian or almost demagogue type presence, because I don't think you can ever reason someone to the point of being a good person if you can't trigger their emotions, and if you can't reason, if you can't persuade them at a more subconscious level, that's not about bullet points or about some sort of axiomatic proof that, you know, stealing is wrong. And I'm reminded of the work of Jonathan Haidt, who talks about the sort of intuitive morality we have, the feeling of morality, and that's really where our moral justifications come from. First, we're disgusted by something, and then we engage our prefrontal cortex and give some basically confabulated explanation for why we think that disgusting thing is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that can go haywire, right? Because you have very disgust-sensitive Christian fundamentalists who are taught to disgust gay people, and so they feel the disgust first, and then they come up with some bogus explanation for why being homosexual is wrong. But that same fundamental apparatus is what's at work every time, you know, we see someone do a good deed on the street, we get a positive glow from it. You know, we feel like, oh, they're great, I'm great, I'm glad to be a part of this. And then we say, oh, well, the golden rule or something like that. So I feel like I'd like for children, you know, in the atheist congregation to be able to just admire and respect at a really gut level whoever the preacher is, and maybe almost even be encouraged to trust this person based on some fiat authority. Not that it can't be challenged, right? It's important that you can still disagree with this person. You can still go up and ask them more questions,
right,
or probe their credentials. So, but I want a middle ground where it's still sort of like, let's say I really admire my father and I always make sure to give to the homeless and give back in charity because I always think of how great a person my father was. We often have figures in our life that we're not just trying to recall what their very persuasive rational argument was. They're just role models.
All right. Well, I hate to disagree with you on your own show, but I'm going to have to strenuously disagree on this point in multiple ways. So first, back to the difficulty, and I may be putting words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong, but back to the point of kind of requiring an authoritarian type figure because it's hard to teach people morality or get people to do the right thing without, through just rational arguments and reason. I disagree because that's not the only thing at our disposal. So it's not that, you know, it sounded to me like you were positioning, well, reason alone won't work, therefore we need authoritarians. Well, it's not just reason and rationality. You can have very basic appeals to emotions as well as helping people understand what their own emotions are and what the emotions of others are. So you can talk to people in terms of, well, how do you feel when that happened to you? How do you think that person felt when it happened to them? So instead of talking about things in terms of judgments, which oftentimes is where reason goes, many times for humans and humanists even, it might not necessarily be reason that is the ultimate driver of ethical behavior. I think a lot of times it's experience, and it's the emotional experiences that we have. And part of being a humanist is trying to improve the experiences of ourselves and others. And I feel that all humans have a strong inclination towards that, except, of course, the handful of psychopaths out there. And that a lot of it is, a lot of the ways to teach people ethical moral behavior is help them help develop their abilities to empathize and help them understand what those situations are that hurt others and help others and help guide them to ways in which they can make other people feel good and in turn make themselves feel good. On the other point, which is kind of the necessity for the authoritarian piece, there's another flaw in that, which is, well, then who watches the watchers, if you will? So, you know, who controls the authoritarian? So if you de facto, basically, if you outsource your morality, much like a job could be outsourced, but you outsource your morality to an authoritarian, you're setting yourself up to give up your own sense of judgment and reason to, and your own emotional experience to, and how that relates to other people, to someone else. And now you've lost your ability to really question that and decide against that. You're saying, well, I'm just going to accept this. They're going to be my moral guidepost. And A, they could have all the best intentions in the world, but be wrong. B, you also set yourself up for people who don't have the best intentions. And there's a whole lot of them out there that prey upon people's emotional and spiritual weaknesses for their own personal gain. See just about all the televangelists. And further, you could have people that may have their best interests of humanity at heart, maybe giving what they think is great advice and what many others may think is great advice, but it might be a bunch of crap. I mean, they might be reciting verses right out of the Bible that to them are wonderful and great, but happen to say that women should be subservient to men and they should not be allowed to teach men anything, which are both New Testament verses that I'm paraphrasing, but are morally repugnant. So the only way to really question that is to be a free thinker and toss out all authority, tradition, and dogma and form opinions based on reason, but also based on emotional experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you talk about outsourcing morality and the dangers of that and the harms that we can see it causing. Whenever you have a position of power, certain unsavory people will gravitate towards it, especially in the case of televangelists, just a position where you can ask for a lot of money. I think it's nice to start with a blank slate, it'd be nice if we could sort of dissolve into anarchy for just a moment and then rebuild. But in the rebuilding process, I think we'd want to come to a point where we still have moral specialists, sort of like representative government. I'm not sure what your feelings are about that. But sort of like we could still, after a certain amount of time, vote in another politician. So we have moral authorities, but we can still walk over to the other atheist church if we want to. And so in a sense, it's up to the larger body of people attending services to be educated and somewhat critical. It's hard to strike that balance because I don't think we want to completely dissolve the trust and respect we have. Because you mentioned the psychology of appealing to emotion, of just telling people how do you feel when someone takes something from you or says something mean to you. How do you think the other person feels? I think that works. But I think having a role model who you'd be ashamed to disappoint is also an effective tactic that can run in parallel. And I don't want to lose that. See?
I can understand that, but you can have the effective role model and they could have authority over, let's say, decisions of the finance of the community, or, you know, are we serving cookies or are we serving ice cream type, you know, management style authority. But I get very concerned when you give somebody the pure moral authority. That gets very dangerous. Moral guidance, somebody who might be a teacher has value, but a teacher or somebody who has a lot of wisdom that they can share, I think has a lot of value without the authority, without saying this is the moral guidepost. That's where you start getting into huge danger zones. Having people who can, you know, maybe give even maybe something akin to a secular sermon, which gives a parable with moral lessons that people can take away, I think is wonderful. And I think for the people who desire that kind of activity, that could have a great deal of value, so long as it's built around the premise of you got to make up your own mind. These are things for you to think on, and these are things that should be questioned.
Right. And there is actually someone in this area on Chapel Hill who does that. I interviewed him, so I met him and got acquainted. He's Randy Best. He's at the Ethical Humanist Society of the Triangle. And it's very much in line with what you're saying. He, any respect or authority that might come out of what he says, he feels should just be from the conversations he's starting and from his track record of his actions and,
right,
and what he said in the past. So
Randy's a good guy.
I get that. Where would you place the Dalai Lama, if you're familiar with him much at all, on the authority to teacher spectrum?
I mean, I'm familiar with him, but I'm not, maybe not enough to answer that specific question.
Yeah.
So it seems like from what I hear, he mostly is giving guidance, but at the same time, I certainly have some disagreements with some things I've heard him say over time, and I certainly disagree with some of the supernatural aspects of the Dalai Lama and some of the stances he's taken. So, you know, it certainly seems to be one of the better religious figures out there, but certainly not without flaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that he can get a lot of reverence because of the supernatural backstory,
right,
of his life. But then he also can act like a teacher often, where he's engaging in discussions with Westerners and scientists and admitting not knowing everything. And he sort of have it both ways. And I sort of wish that we could have more leaders who would have it both ways without the supernatural backstory.
Right. And I think what one of the things you just said is the key to all of this is being able to admit, I don't know. And that really gets down to the nature of these things is, if you've got leaders and teachers that can admit, I don't know, and who are willing to say right out, I'm going to give you some advice, but I could be wrong. You need to judge for yourself. I'm going to give you some data points, and you should use that and incorporate that into your own thinking. That's where we start getting into places where people can make decisions for their own benefit, are defended better from being manipulated, and where we can get down to, you know, really true, pure, good morality and people doing things for the right reasons rather than because they're told to do so.
Yeah. Well, I have to agree with that. I think we're on a similar page there. I think part of what could help here, as I mentioned, the Dalai Lama, is expanding which religions we're taking from, making sure to look at all world religions. I think that Buddhism and Jainism and these more non-theistic religions might be doing things that are a little more acceptable to free thinkers. It's just another place to mine insights.
Yeah, I agree with that. There certainly they have a lot of things that are more in line with what we're thinking. I actually was at a Buddhist temple about a year ago for the Religion News Writers Association was having their convention here in the Triangle, and they did a retreat during one of the lunches off to this Buddhist temple. And I was looking through some of their literature. I'm like, wow, good, good, like it, like it, like it. Oh, wait, this is a little crazy here. There's some stuff about ghosts and reincarnation, and they're almost there. They're almost there. They just need to take that one or two extra steps and get the rest of the way.
Right. Yeah, there's the ghosts and the reincarnation. And then in the case of Buddhism, there's also an interesting ideological view of human psychology and of the lives we live. This idea that at some fundamental level, we're always going to meet suffering, disappointment in life if we're too attached. And the level of detachment that seems to be advocated is not very comfortable to me. So it's just another place where there's room to disagree and ask questions. And I think many Buddhists would be willing to admit they don't know to some degree.
Yeah, the whole life is suffering foundation of a religion seems awfully pessimistic to me. I think, you know, that the root of that has always been an enormous turnoff for me personally, even if some of the other aspects of their religion might be more appealing than most of the others.
Right. Well, I think what's such a radical worldview, I don't know if I should call it radical, what such a sort of counterintuitive reframing of our life can do is get us to rethink our mental habits and our daily decisions, and that maybe if we're not jarred like that by a statement like everything you do is going to lead to some disappointment or suffering, then you're not going to reevaluate yourself as much as you could. Mm-hmm. You're going to miss an opportunity to improve yourself.
Which I think the quest for enlightenment is overall mostly a noble quest. Now, I think there's certain hazards in setting up an ideal of enlightenment, which becomes somewhat of a search for perfection, which will end in suffering. And perhaps that's why the suffering is built into the system. If you're starting searching for perfection, yeah, you're going to find suffering because you're going to be disappointed. But the search to continuously improve oneself is certainly a noble quest, and I think is a lot of what humanism is about. Is looking at ourselves, looking at the world around us, and trying to make things better and trying to create more enjoyment and reducing suffering.
Mm. What's your take on the terminology of humanism, secular humanism, versus just atheism, ethical humanism? It seems like there are lots of things you can stick in front of humanism, but humanism is the banner for an ethical system combined with a secular worldview. Does that sound right?
Well, so the definitions I use, and sometimes they do differ from person to person a little bit, but you know, there's atheism, which is simply, in relation to gods and gods, a lack of belief. Then there's agnosticism, which is, in relation to God or gods, knowledge. So a lack of knowledge or the belief that God, it's unknowable that there are God or gods. So there's your basic atheist agnostic. Do you believe? No, I'm an atheist. Do you know? No, I'm an agnostic. I'm both an atheist and agnostic. Now, those are really just literally just confined to those concepts only, belief and knowledge. The next level of that, to me, is humanism. And that is kind of a life stance or a philosophy of trying to be good and trying to lead a moral, ethical life without the supernatural. I'm also a humanist. Now, there's secular humanists and religious humanists. Most people who would call themselves humanists are pretty much secular humanists at this point in time. There have been people who've called themselves religious humanists in history and who've burned Christians at the stake. So, you know, there's good and bad, but there's certainly currently religious humanists now that, you know, are essentially deists or exceptionally liberal Christians that are more humanist than anything else in their day-to-day lives. And more power to those people. I think that's a pretty good way to go through life as well. We will disagree with certain aspects, but that's fine. I'm all three of those. I'm not necessarily an ethical culturist. They're essentially humanists, but they see their humanism as a religion, and ethics is the core of the religion. And I see ethics as the kind of the core of my life stance, but I don't see my humanism is a religion. I see it as an alternative to religion. And I see there's certainly certain parallels and certain aspects of religion that should be taken, but the core of religion to me is really the supernatural aspects as well as the authority aspects and dogma, and I reject all of those pieces. So what I strive for and what I think would ultimately lead to a world better for all of its inhabitants is something where we toss out the dogma and the authority and work to be better because it's the right thing to do. It makes us feel good, and it makes the world a better place.
Yeah. Well, you know, Todd, I think we should leave it at that because that's such an eloquent parting note.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it, Jose.
And thanks so much to you. For our listeners, this is Todd Stiefel, and he's the big screen. Todd Stiefel is the co-host of the Humanist Hour and an activist in the Free Thought Movement. And I'm Jose Dras Lopez, the host of Psych Talk. Do you want to give the URL for Humanist Hour?
It's thehumanisthour.org, and you can find more about my foundation at stiefelfreethoughtfoundation.org, and you can also find us on Facebook.
Great. And for Psych Talk, we're psychtalkradio.com, PSYCH talkradio.com. Thanks so much.